The following is an exclusive presentation of WI Garden Media, the voice of Garden Talk Radio. Coming up on the program today, we're going to go over how you can grow great garlic in your garden, as well as understanding the multitudes of different types of cooking flour that are out there. And author Lori Bull will be with us, and we'll answer your garden questions. That's all this hour, and it starts right now.
You are listening to the most informationally packed hour of garden-focused radio in the country and on the internet with your host, husband and wife team Joey and Holly Baird. This is the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show.
Welcome to the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show. Happy that you've allowed us to be part of your day and hanging out with us for the next hour. I am your host, Joey Baird. Beside me is my wife, co-host, best friend, and gardening partner,
Holly Baird.
This program is for you, about you, to help your garden grow better, to maintain your landscape, grow healthier trees, make your grass look greener, as well as preserving what you grow. There's a number of ways in which you can get a hold of us, and we thank you for however you're capturing the program, whether that be on one of the 15 radio stations in the U.S. that are broadcasting our program here in 2021, through a radio app, through the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com Season 5 tab at the top of the page, our parent website, podcast replay, or in-studio video replay. Thank you. If you'd like to get a hold of us, you can do that by sending us an email with your question, comment, or just saying hi to GardenTalkRadio at gmail.com. That's GardenTalkRadio at gmail.com. If you'd like to talk with us directly, you can do that by putting your fingers in your mobile device and dialing us up at 1-800-927-SHOW. That's 1-800-927-7469. Big show lined up for you. We're going to get right into it. And in a way of how you can grow great garlic in your garden. And there's really, it's how you say garlic is stupid easy to grow.
Right. That's exactly what I say, is that it's very easy, stupid easy to grow. So the biggest thing is you want to decide what type of garlic you want to grow. And we're not talking about what variety necessarily, but it's, there's two different types. There's the hard neck and the soft neck.
Two categories.
Yeah. Two main categories. So the hard neck is the one that is, has a stronger flavor. You can get the scapes from it. So it's almost like you have two harvests or two, produces something.
You get a bonus.
You get a bonus.
Bonus harvest, yeah.
And that's the one that the stem goes through the middle. And then the soft neck is the one that does store a little bit longer. It has a more mild flavor, and it doesn't have that scape.
Now, which is best for you? Well, it depends on where you're at. I mean, hard neck and soft neck can grow in most parts of the country. Now, garlic growing in the southern portions is a little more challenging than in the northern areas. Predominantly, hard neck garlic is recommended for the colder climates. Soft neck garlic is more geared towards the warmer winters. Both can be grown in the north, and that's where we are at. There's garlic growers that do very successful growing soft neck garlic in the colder climates of the United States. So it really is up to you what you would want to pick from. A couple of things you want to keep in mind is, whenever you decide which one of those you want to get, some people will be like, hey, I want to get as many cloves, or I want big cloves, or I want a lot of cloves. It really depends on the variety. Mm-hmm. Some have four, some had 15, based on the type of garlic variety in which it's just like tomatoes. Some are big tomatoes, some are little tomatoes, so on and so forth.
Right. So, yeah. So you definitely want to keep that in mind. Also, you want to think about where you're going to grow this garlic. But before you decide where you're going to grow it, you may have to obtain the garlic. And you can get the garlic from lots of different places, but you don't want to get it from your like big box regular grocery store. So you can get it from the farmer's market. You can get it from a garlic supplier. You could see if a friend is willing to give you some to get started. So any combination of those. You want to make sure you hopefully know the variety, if it's hard neck or soft neck. And then also if it's something that you want to, maybe if you have a variety of garlic that you get and you want to continue to keep those varieties separated. Like we grow Spanish Roja, German Hardy, Georgia Crystal are the three main ones. We don't separate ours. We kind of just throw them mishmash all together. But some people do keep them separate.
And the reason why we do not separate, you know, variety type of thing is because we look at the harvest time. The biggest a bulb contains the largest cloves is what we plant for the following year in the hopes that we get large bulbs of garlic again. So we may have only, you know, if we plant 100 cloves of garlic, which is not uncommon for us, maybe we only have one purple glazer. Maybe we have 93 Spanish Roja. We don't know.
Right. We don't know at this point, and that's fine for us.
I want to touch on elephant garlic, Holly, because people think, oh, I'll just grow elephant garlic because it's garlic.
Elephant garlic is not officially garlic. It is part of the Allium family, so it is it's basically a cousin or whatever of a leek or an onion. And garlic is technically kind of in that family, but not quite the same. So elephant garlic is part of the leek family. It's not a true garlic, but it does have garlic flavor, and it does have cloves. But you can grow it in one season. Like, you can plant it in the spring and then harvest in the summer.
Now, some people will try to grow garlic in one season, plant it in the spring, harvest it in the fall. We have tried that. We haven't had that great success with it. What we find that works best for us is we plant it in the fall, approximately 30 days, give or take, based on your area, before the first hard freeze. So we take the first Saturday in October each year, rain or shine, and we've planted it in the mud before, and we plant our garlic. It overwinters. There's going to be a little bit of top growth that develops prior to the snow or the freeze or the cold weather coming. That's totally normal. And then we leave it alone. And then we harvest it based on the variety between June and July the coming year. So we're setting at about a 9-month investment in of real estate, whether that's a designated garden bed or if you've intermingled it along your house with the roses or the flowers or other means of vegetation.
Right. So you can plant it there. The biggest thing is you want to rotate it. So if you planted garlic there that year, like this year, like you harvested this year, you don't want to plant in the same spot next year. Also, same thing goes for onions or leeks or anything in that family, the Allium family, shallots. You don't want to plant there. You don't want to plant, if there was onions there this year, don't plant your garlic there. Wait a year.
Wait a year. Let everything cycle through. Unlike other varieties of vegetables or fruits in which you may be growing that you could, you know, sneak in a second year in the same bed, these you don't want to do that to.
Right.
What you want to also keep in mind is at the time of planting, let's talk about the selection of the clove, because that's your key. People will plant from seed, but the clove is the recommended because of the short growing time frame which it gives you and the more control over what you have. Whenever you're buying it from a garlic supplier, garlic online supplier, Whole food type of organic food store, and you can get the variety identified, you're wanting to, let's say you're going to plant next Saturday. So you're going to leave things all intact, just like you bought the bulb, until probably about Thursday evening. Then you're going to start breaking that apart, leaving the skin intact. Do not remove the little paper stuff that separates or is covering the clove. You're looking for the largest cloves in that bulb of garlic. So you can, once selected, those large cloves, and a bulb may contain 8 cloves and 6 may be huge and 2 may be small. You can plant them all. That's not against the rules here. You can put all of them in the ground. But at that point, about 24 hours before you intend to put them in the ground, you can hydrate them. What are some options when it comes to hydrating your bulbs, and how do you hydrate your garlic cloves?
Sure, you can hydrate them in just plain water. You can use a compost tea. That's pretty much it. I don't know what else you would hydrate them in, but you just take them, put them in that liquid, and then you let them sit overnight. And you hydrating them will make them germinate a little bit quicker, but it's not required.
Not required. And the reason why you may want to, like, and you're thinking, well, why do I want them to germinate quicker when they're going to go into dormancy? You want to get that root establishment completed prior to them getting cold and going into dormancy. We're talking in the ground, physical in the ground, or in a raised bed. You can grow these in a container. However, a larger the container, the better, because when we think of the ground freezing, we think it's rock solid. There's nothing. Technically, the ground doesn't freeze rock solid. A container does, like an ice cube, a 5 gallon, 10 gallon, 15 gallon grow bag or container. When it freezes, it is absolutely an ice cube solid. The ground doesn't. So back to we've soaked our garlic cloves for 24 hours and we're going to plant them. We in the raised bed ground, we plant them about 2.5 to 3 inches deep. Now you don't have to get the ruler out or the tape measure. Make a drill and just drop them in. If you're in a raised bed, you go 4 inches. You're not going to have it too big of a problem. And you're going to space them, the book says, or the internet says, Holly, about 12 inches. We find 8 really works pretty well.
Right. You can plant them 8 apart. That's not a problem. So you want to plant them with the pointy side up, just like it comes off the bulb. And then, again, 2 to 3 inches deep. And that's how you plant them. Now, you can put some mulch on where they are. If you do use mulch, you just want to use, like, maybe 1 inch of mulch. You don't want to put, like, 3 feet. We made that mistake once. So just a thin layer of mulch, about 1 inch of mulch. And then they will sprout. You'll see them sprout before winter. But then that's okay. You don't have to worry about that. In the spring, when you go out to your garden to kind of work the soil, whatever, you will see them sprouting more. You can, at that point, if you wanted to, you could fertilize, side dress, whatever. And if for whatever reason you live in an area that they might need water, our springs here are extremely wet. But if you think that they would need water, you can certainly water in the spring.
Now, back to the planting. We go 8 inches from plant to plant and about a foot from row to row. That works out very well. If you are one of these individuals similar to us who prefer a visual of what we are speaking about, you can go to our parent website, thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com, and in the search bar on the right-hand side of the top, just put in garlic planting. And we've got about 6 or 7 videos that walk through exactly what we are describing on the radio here of how to do that. So that's another avenue in which you can to learn and interact with us as well. So that's pretty much it. I mean, you got the scapes. We talked about that. They will occur about 4 to 6 weeks prior to the harvest of the garlic. When you see the scapes occur, you're going to – that's an additional growth coming out only on the hardneck garlic out of the central stem of the plant. Once it does a twist or a curl, you can – harvest that and use that.
You just trim it right at the junction where it comes out of the plant. And then you...
If you
don't, it's going to put its energy, its growing energy, into producing that scape into a seed pod, because plants only care about reproducing for them, their survival. They don't care that you want to eat those delicious garlic cloves.
It'll actually make the bulb smaller in the ground, right? Because the energy is stored in the bulb and then it's storing that to make that seed production.
Right. So you want to trim the scapes, and then once you're done with that, within 2 to 4 weeks, you'll start to see the lower leaves of the garlic plant kind of die back, turn yellow brown. Then you know it's time to harvest. If you grow soft neck garlic, the necks or the tops are going to fall over just like onions do.
And you can use it right away, or you can cure it and store it. Whichever method you do that, you want to dig the garlic out of the ground with a shovel, with a fork. You do not want to physically pull it out, because in the curing process, in a form of which you hang or set the plants vertical out of the ground in a container or hang off a wall or an eaves, you're allowing the energy that is in the stem to gravitate pull back into the bulb to add a little more flavor. And if you do yank the stalk out of the garlic bulb, you're going to have to dig the bulb out anyways, so you might as well just make one move, use a garden fork or a shovel, and gently pull them out of the ground. So that's a real down and dirty quick way of how you can grow successful garlic. You don't have to be a master gardener to grow garlic. You don't even have to be really any type of gardener to grow really good garlic. You just got to get it in the ground.
Right. So with that being said, we know that growing food, just like garlic is important to you, well, so is where maybe your food, other food comes from. The Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show is brought to you today by our sponsors, Walton's Inc. Listen, we know you care about where your food comes from with the preserving your fruits and vegetables, but if you think about, you know, maybe where your meat comes from, Walton's Inc. has all the equipment, seasoning, and supplies to make jerky, snack sticks, whatever, to your high standards. Want to make snack sticks that people will actually like? There is a website called meatlogistics.com to help people educate on the hows and whys of meat processing. And there's almost 15,000 users who will help you with your process. Otherwise, if you go to waltonsinc.com, they have everything from sausage, stuffers, mixers, grinders, all sorts of things to help you go from animal to edible. Again, that's waltonsinc.com or meatlogistics.com.
Do not go anywhere. When we come back, it's going to be about different types of flour, what you should know, and the confusion in which it can present to you in the grocery store or online. You're listening to the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show.
Got a question for Joey and Holly? Send it via email anytime to gardentalkradio@gmail.com.
We here at the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show Gardens understand that healthy soil is the key to a successful garden. We know that chemical fertilizer burns carbon out of the soil and kills the microbes needed for a healthy soil ecosystem. No worries. Chicken Soup for the Soil by Dr. Jims will stimulate life into your soil, supplying all the nutrients most fertilizers neglect. Rather than force-feeding water-soluble chemical fertilizer, we suggest feeding the microbes a smorgasbord of 100% biodegradable nutrients that your plants can consume when they need them. The nutrients are readily available to maximize their genetic potential. Chicken Soup for the Soil will increase the quality of the fruit and vegetables you grow. Visit drjims.com. That's drjims.com. The number one key to healthy, productive plants are the roots. Starting from seed to full-grown plants, RootMaker.com has the answer. From seed starting trays with an innovative design that air prunes the roots, creating a fabulous root system, never again will you have root-bound plants, to multiple gallon grow bag sizes to raised beds. RootMaker.com has your grow needs covered. Visit RootMaker.com. Use coupon code RADIO21 and get 15% off your entire order.
Straight from the farm, fields, and briar patch, Piper and Leaf Artisan Tea is a tea like you've never imagined it. Get our award-winning tea delivered right to your front door and become part of the Piper and Leaf family. Free shipping over $75 at piperandleaf.com.
Tired of dealing with bugs but don't want to use harmful chemicals to repel them? Naturally Green No More Bugs is all natural and plant-based. No more chemical bug repellent. Use it around your home and on you, indoors and out. DEET-free and will not stain. Repels mosquitoes, ticks, fleas, roaches, ants, flies, and more. No More Bugs is the answer to what is bugging you. Stop using harmful chemicals and use what is safe for you, your family, pets, and the environment. For more information, visit natgreenproducts.com. natgreenproducts.com. Brought to you by Blue Ribbon Organics, providing locally made organic compost and soil blends for gardens, farms, landscaping, and more. Visit BlueRibbonOrganics.com or call 262-497-8539 to find their products nearest you. The Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show is brought to you by the following: Blue Ribbon Organics, Naturally Green Products, Ironwood Tool Company, Easy Step Products, Rinse Kit, Soul Brew Kombucha, Wild Delight, Rincon Vitova, Chip Drop, Bailbuster.com. Find all sponsors at the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com and thank them for their support. Welcome back to the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show. Thank you for hanging with us. You got some problems and have faced problems this year with not being able to keep your vegetables, your fruit trees, your shrubs, all of that hydrated. Well, have you not used Tree Diaper? Tree Diaper is the product that will fix all of those problems for you and a whole lot more.
Yeah, if your ear plants could talk, they're going to tell you, especially by now, that they would want to be properly watered.
First of all, if your plants could talk, that we've got a whole other show going on. Yeah, go ahead.
Either, you know, they get too much or too little. How do you water properly? Maybe you don't know how to, maybe you don't have the option of something like irrigation. You
can take the time.
Or the time. You can take the guesswork out by using the tree diaper. Tree diaper is a revolutionary watering system that stabilizes soil moisture by taking up excess water and slowly releases it when plants need it. The tree diaper is filled with water from rain or when you water and slowly releases water over 3 weeks. No pipes, hoses, or electricity needed, whether you're a first-time gardener or advanced. Tree diaper will improve the way you water your plants. It's made in the USA. You can check out all the sizes they have available. Tree diaper will keep your plants happy. That's treediaper.com. Treediaper.com.
Again, no hoses. You don't have to hook anything up. You charge it, put it in the garden, and when it rains, it recharges. Water's over 30. Fantastic product. Treediaper.com. Well, Holly, a lot of people over this last 18 months have spent more time at home than maybe they wanted to. And the confusion comes whenever they decide that they want to bake or cook or make a pie. That there's a lot of different options out there when it comes to flour. So before we get started with the different types of flour, we do want to make you aware that, and Janie's Mill is a sponsor of the program. They've been with us all year. Janie's Mills is a certified organic kosher, high quality wheat, rye, oat, corn, buckwheat, heirloom, and ancient grain facility that provides you with those different types of flours and grains at janiesmill.com. They care about what you put on your table. Visit janiesmill.com.
So the important thing to keep in mind about flour is the protein content. And I actually knew this. It's funny, when I was going to do the show notes, I was like, I really know a lot about flour. So the protein content is what differentiates different flours. So high protein wheat varieties are classified as hard wheat, which is like the 10 to 14%. And then the low protein wheat is the soft wheat. That's the 5 to 10%. So basically the more protein equals more gluten, which means more strength. So if you think about that, bread flour is typically a hard wheat, and it has more gluten, which is more protein, which means that it's good for the separate risings, the kneading, all of that, where you are constantly working the flour. You can make bread with like an all-purpose flour, but it's not going to rise the same because you're eventually working that protein too much.
So essentially, with the higher protein or the gluten, there's little webs of this item in there, and the more you work it, because it's got a higher content, you're not destroying those connections as you would with a lighter.
Right.
Okay.
And this makes a difference also if you are trying to make a pastry where it's supposed to be light and fluffy. If you use bread flour, it's going to be dense.
Okay.
So it's something to keep in mind.
And people may be doing that and not really, because they have flour. Flour's flour. Just grab it and go.
What's funny is that my best friend, Laura, she was making, I don't know, banana bread or something. And she was like, I don't know what I did wrong. She's like, I followed the recipe. It just came out really dense and tasteless.
She had a brick. She had a brick.
And I was like, what type of flour are you using? She's like, oh, I just use this whole grain whatever flour. And I was like, well, that's why. I'm like, the whole grain flour is not as light and fluffy as like an all-purpose flour. So unless it's labeled whole wheat, all flour is white flour. It's milled from the starchy innermost part of the wheat kernel, also known as the endosperm. So flour, you know, you might think, oh, I'm just going to make some bread and flour's flour, and that's certainly not it. All-purpose flour is just that it's an all-purpose flour. It's a soft wheat, so it has like a medium protein, and it's good for all that typical baking.
So what you're saying is that the women and the men, everybody who's listening, they may have thought that they were a terrible baker. They may be a fantastic baker. They just may be using the incorrect flour in order to do their baked goods.
Right.
And it could be, you know.
Right. This past winter, my friend and I both made ciabatta, which is a process where you do actually have to work with some fermented mother dough.
And you do that via video Zoom or something like that.
We just sent pictures back.
Okay.
All right. But he didn't read the recipe, and he uses all-purpose flour, and I read the recipe, and I used bread flour, and mine definitely got more of a rise, and his was more of a flatter, almost ciabatta.
Now, when we talk about gluten, there's some people that actually it's medical that they cannot, or it's not good for them to consume gluten.
Right. That's the protein that's in flour. Right. And that's something that they would have to figure out for themselves. I'm going to talk about good old gluten flour.
Okay.
And we can touch on gluten-free at the end.
All right.
So cake flour, this is one that is the lowest protein content. So this is going to make your cake nice and fluffy and not a brick. So you want to keep that in mind. Now, pastry flour is, it's an unbleached, I was going to mention all-purpose flour. If it's unbleached or bleached, it doesn't matter. That doesn't make a difference. That's really up to you. If you're making, like a yellow cake or a whitish cake or something like that, you probably want to use unbleached. Otherwise, it might look a little beige. And maybe that's not appealing to everybody.
Okay.
A lot of times, if you're making a cake and you're not using cake flour, you're using all-purpose, which is fine. You want to keep in mind, like, a lot of people look at the layers of the cake or something and they think it's pretty, so bleach would be better. So, pastry flour is another type of baking flour, but it has a little bit more protein and allows for that flakiness and that tenderness. Because you are going to roll pastry flour, so it needs a little bit more of that protein.
Now, when it comes to doing that, whenever we're talking about the different layers of the cake and the bleached or unbleached, people, regardless if the taste is phenomenal, people will look at it with their eyes and going, if it doesn't look right, they'll go, I don't think so. Because it's the eyes first, then the taste. Is it better to use unbleached? Is there a chemical there that people feel that maybe unsafe to use?
That's up to you.
Okay.
Personal preference. Yeah, personal preference. So bread flour, as we talked about, that has the high protein content. So it's the strongest. Uh-huh. It's going to allow you to knead the dough, work the dough. You know,
a bread machine.
Like a bread machine, yeah. I'm just going to bring up the ciabatta again because that was the last bread that I baked. You know, I started with mother dough where I used the bread flour with a little, I think it was yeast. I let that sit for 24 hours, and then I added my flour to it slowly. But I had to work it several times over and over because in that working process, it allowed for like these air pockets essentially to help the bread. So if I did that with an all-purpose flour, it eventually doesn't have enough of that protein, that high gluten, to keep making it stretchy and malleable, and then it's not going to give you the proper rise.
Okay. Now, flours typically come from wheat, but there are other flours that are available that come from beans, different grains. Are those good for bread making, or do you need or is that going to make that dense brick that you need to put behind the wheel of the wagon so it doesn't roll down the hill?
You can use gluten-free flours to bake bread, but you definitely want to, some people like to experiment. Mm-hmm. And B, a lot of times you have to add something like egg or xanthan gum or
arrowroot
flour. Right. Yeah. So you have to definitely have to follow. I mean, you should follow recipes for all of your baking because baking is a science. Mm-hmm. But you also want to make sure that when it comes to gluten-free baking, there's flours that are more favorable for like baking a bread versus something that maybe if you're going to use it for cooking, like breading chicken or something.
Now, whole bleach flour, unbleached flour, dime a dozen. The specialty flours are a little like you would get at your natural food store, a little more on the expensive side, but there is a benefit. Or, you know, you get what you pay for. And if you're looking for a specialty flour for a reason of health or just experimenting, that's not a bad avenue to go. It's maybe a little more an investment than getting a 25-pound bag of bleached flour for, you know, $12.
Right. So I wanted to mention, I know a lot of people are really into the whole grain thing, which is fine. So if you make bread with a whole grain flour, while whole grain flour does have a higher protein content, there's the germ part, which is the wheat germ. That's the part that doesn't get milled out as much as like in a a highly all-purpose processed flour.
It doesn't get removed or separated.
Right.
Yeah.
Same thing with the wheat bran. So when you have, even though you have that higher protein content, the wheat bran and the wheat germ brings it down a little bit. So you can make bread with it, but sometimes it like it'll the recipe will call for like half whole wheat and half like all-purpose or something.
Right.
Or bread flour, so that you have that gluten protein content to make a successful bread.
Now, with Janie's Mill, they have ancient grains, they have oats, they have cornmeal, all of that stuff. So it's more of a traditional flour manufacturing company. I do want to talk about weevil in the flour. If you get a bag of all-purpose bleached or unbleached flour and you let it set 4, 6, 8, 12, 14 months and you open it up, you're going to have white flour, but you're going to have little black dots in there. We've experienced this. This is called weevil. During the farming process, whenever the grain is harvested and stored in a bin or a granary or a facility, there are tablets in which first you spray the area with a toxic spray, and then once the grain is put in there, then you take these very potent tablets and you shove in the grain, and then over time it will immerse the gases in order to kill the weevil. Not all weevil is killed. The purpose of removing the weevil is the weevil will eat the inside of the grain of wheat out, and then you have no value and no weight, and it's a waste. So whenever you see the black dots, those are most likely weevil, dead or alive, and technically it's not unhealthy. It is safe to consume them. So if you only have flour that have a little weevil in it, just go ahead and use it. Totally safe to do such. But most people are very put off by seeing this in their flour and will dispose of the flour altogether. But that is what you're getting. That's what you see. And technically, even if the flour is purchased tomorrow and you use it, there are certain microscopic amounts of weevil eggs in there that, if left alone, would hatch.
And that's actually a huge reason why they say don't eat raw cookie dough unless it's safe for eating, because it's not necessarily the egg. It's the raw flour. And if you, like you said, not that the weevil is bad, but the raw flour can be harmful to some people.
Well, you know what is also harmful, Holly? Those Japanese beetles. Summer's just about over. Most of the kids are back in school. Nights are getting cooler. Days are getting shorter. And you've probably forgotten about that lawn that you shouldn't have, and the lawn's a little sad.
Yeah, just because it's fall, we don't want to forget about our yards and those Japanese beetles either. They may be gone, but they're not far away. Not only did they feast on your roses and berries this summer, they laid eggs in your turf so that they can start again next year. You want to take a stand with Phylum's Grub Gun. Grub Gun is a non-chemical BT granular that specifically targets the scarab pests and their larvae. You simply apply the granule with a spreader, irrigate into the soil, and let the naturally occurring bacteria do its job.
Not only is Grub Gun easy to use, but it is the only non-chemical choice that effectively controls those grubs that are in your yard. And the best part about it, it's non-toxic to bees, butterflies, and other beneficial insects. In fact, Grub Gun has zero label restrictions on for flowers and applications around flowers, so you don't have to get down and remove those flowers to prevent those beneficial insects from taking up the poison that other products would leave and tainting their hives. Have you checked it out? That's Grub Gun from phylumbioproducts.com, the natural choice. That's phylum bioproducts.com. Well, hang out. Don't go anywhere. Lauren Bull, author, will be with us right after this. You're listening in the Garden with Joey and Holly radio show.
Got a question for Joey and Holly? Send it via email anytime to gardentalkradio@gmail.com.
You move your lawn sprinklers all over the yard, but you always end up putting them in the same spots. Why not just bury them there? Out of sight, always ready to use, pre-adjusted to water the precise areas you want. Quick Snap Sprinklers makes it easy. In-ground sprinklers without the hassle or expense of laying pipe. Put the sprinklers anywhere in your lawn or garden. Snap on a hose to supply the water. Water on, it pops up. Water off, it drops below ground. You can mow right over it. You can have a buried sprinkler system up and running in just minutes. Each QuickSnap saves thousands of dollars. They install in minutes and operate for years. Visit quicksnapsprinkler.com. With the right tools, plant maintenance is easy and more effective. Ironwood Tool Company has the right tools for your project. From pruners to loppers to saws and shears and cleanup tools, get the right tool for this season, making your job much easier. Find them all at ironwoodtools.com. Rinse kit, your hose on the go. No pumping, no batteries. Simply fill from your spigot or sink. On your way out for up to 5 minutes of spray time anywhere. Spray it, wash it, rinse kit. Hello, I'm Joey Baird from the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show. If you're looking for merchandise for the program, you can go to thatismyshirt.com and get shirts with our logos on it. If you'd want to go a different route, they have a lot of comical, logical, and witty sayings on shirts that you can wear that makes a statement. From valedictorian from Common Sense University to I Heart Compost to Don't Be Just Average Today, and a number of other great sayings. It all can be found at thatismyshirt.com. thatismyshirt.com. Sizes from small to 5 extra large and multiple colors per shirt to choose from. thatismyshirt.com. The Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show is brought to you by the following: Simply Earth, Seed Savers Exchange, Quick Snap Sprinklers, Water Hoop, Timber Pro Coatings, Bloomin' Easy Plants, Pomona Universal Pectin, Ivy Organics, Tiger Torch, Happy Leaf LED, Seed Link. Find all sponsors at thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com and thank them for their support. Welcome back to the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show. Moments away, Lori Bull. But first, got some problems with yellow jackets. Rescue has that solution ready for you.
During these dry summer months, you will notice that there are more aggressive yellow jackets flying around. They are looking for your barbecue meat, sweet drinks, and anything sweet or water sources they can get to. You want to keep them at bay with the Rescue yellow jacket traps. Rescue yellow jacket traps are an eco-friendly do-it-yourself option to keep those stingy pests away from you. They use a powerful lure for yellow jackets, and they will not attract beneficial honeybees. All Rescue products are made in the USA. You can go to rescue.com. That is rescue.com.
Holly, let's go to the hotline and bring in our guest for this week.
Yeah, Lori Bull is an author, gardener, and garden writer. And she is a lifelong resident of the Pacific Northwest. Her book is titled Fearless Gardening, and she loves all types of spiky plants and more. Welcome to the program, Lori.
Thank you much, and love to be here.
Well, let's talk about your blog. It's called Danger Garden. Why is it called that, and what is your passion that got you into the spiky plant world?
So my husband actually came up with the name Danger Garden. I wanted to start a blog, and I was trying to come up with a catchy name, and we had just adopted a pug. And as you know, that breed of dog has kind of big, bulgy eyes, and I have a lot of so he suggested Danger Garden, and I thought, yep, that sounds about right. My passion there is really gardening with spiky desert plants in the Pacific Northwest is a little odd. So by starting a blog, I was able to connect with people all around the country who grow the kind of plants that I love. But I also learned of a very tight-knit group here in Portland who actually grows those same kind of plants and are avid gardeners. So my passion has turned into basically all things gardening.
Now, had your passion always been about spiky plants as a young girl, or did you stumble into this?
I kind of stumbled into it. I went on a business trip to Arizona when I was working for Williams-Sonoma and was blown away at what I saw. Being from the Pacific Northwest, I had never seen the cactus scenes that are so, you know, everywhere there. And I was just in awe and fell in love.
That's great. So many people are not sure about growing succulents, cacti, et cetera. And maybe, you know, maybe somebody gifted them one of these plants and they either kept it alive by some miracle
or it's on life support.
What are some good varieties and some tips for growing these types of plants if you're a newbie?
That's a great question. And I hesitate to recommend specific plants because all gardening is so local. So I really think the best way for people to get started is to walk around your neighborhood, Go to areas that you know there are avid gardeners and see what they're growing in their gardens. Ask them questions. Chances are they may give you some plants that you can go home and plant in your garden. Or if you're growing them as a houseplant person, which is very on trend right now, mail order is fabulous for finding a specific plant that you're renting for, but maybe not the best for learning about that plant. So again, I think that it's really important that you go to your local nursery and you soak up the knowledge that is available there. But I will say, the prickly pear, opuntia, my parents call them monkey ears. Those plants are native to all but three of our continental United States. So they are a great one to get started with. And they come in all sizes, from little tiny windowsill size cactus to pads that are bigger than my head, and they grow to car size patches. So the opuntia or prickly pear is a great one to start with.
Now, you brought up the going to your garden center. We've all gone to the big box stores. We see all kinds of cacti or succulents in very poor condition, but people buy them. Do you recommend just staying clear of that and, as you say, go to a garden center where there's experts, even though in some instances you may pay a tad more, but you're going to get the quality with that too?
Definitely, I recommend that. But, you know, I say that and I'm hugely contradicting what I do myself, because you're there buying something else and you have to walk through the garden center, through the garden department. It's just what we do, right? And there's that desire to rescue a plant that isn't looking good. So I've done that. Sometimes they're beyond help. Sometimes you get a great bargain. But I think that you really want to identify what it is that you bought. And sometimes the labels there are not very helpful. Right. So going online and finding a group that can tell you, yes, that is an agave perii rather than just succulent assorted, will help you do some research and figure out what it is you have and set you up for success.
Now, once you get one of these plants that are healthy and you're able to keep alive, are a lot of these plants, are you able to propagate by cutting, or how can you expand what from one plant?
Many of them, like agaves, some aloes, send out pups, which are baby plants around the mother plant that you've planted. So those are really easy to dig up or unpot and pull away and repot, and you have another plant, or you can give it to a friend. The opuntia that I mentioned earlier, you just break off one of those pads and stick it in, let it callus over, let the end dry up so it doesn't rot, and stick it in some soil, and it's going to start growing. So those are the easiest ways to propagate. I am not a seed person. I know you can grow these plants from seed if you get a bloom and you have seed set, but I'm not patient enough for that. So I like to propagate by just separating pups or breaking off pads. Many of the softer aloes, like the echeveria, you can take a leaf and stick it. Did I say aloes? Softer succulents like echeveria. You can just lay it on the soil and it will grow a new plant, send out roots, and it's pretty amazing.
And I'm assuming that from seed, we're talking years, not weeks or months.
Exactly. And I just don't have that kind of patience. I'm in awe of the people who do, but that's not me.
That's totally understandable. Now, your book is called Fearless Gardening. What can our listeners expect when they pick up a copy? And what is something maybe unique or noteworthy that would intrigue them?
So I wanted to write a book that gave permission to people to experiment, make mistakes, you know, even if that meant killing plants, to just get out there and have fun. I think that my book is unique in that it's not a how-to. I'm not telling you how to go about doing whatever it is that you're wanting to do in your garden. I'm just encouraging you to get out there and experiment, make mistakes. If it doesn't work, try again, come up with a different way of doing it. Gardening really isn't an end result that you're aiming for. It's a process. You're constantly learning. You're reinventing what you want from your garden. And I talk about all that in the book and give people great examples of how I break the rules, encourage them to break the rules, and just really enjoy it.
Okay, great. So we are talking with Lori Bull. She's an author, gardener, garden writer. And so, you know, you talked about propagating some of the different plants. For one question, I don't know if you've ever propagated aloe, but we had attempted it and it wasn't successful. And we found that a lot of people make, I guess, mistakes or maybe don't have much experience. Do you have any tips for propagating aloe?
Because aloes are not, I back up. There are two aloes that are hardy here in my garden. So I don't really have a lot of experience propagating them. One of them is no longer classified as aloe, but Aloe aristata, which does form pups, and I've separated them and replanted them. I don't have a lot of experience with aloes because I have so many agaves and other succulents in containers that I haven't branched out to plant a lot of aloes in containers. So I'm sorry, I'm kind of letting you down on that one.
It's okay. So you did say that, you know, you can definitely like wait for a pup and separate that when it comes to any of these, you know, succulents or cactus. Is there any other tips you recommend for people that do want to separate and, you know, propagate to keep in mind? Is it just pretty basic as much as recognizing where to separate it, or any other tips there?
It is so easy that I think I take for granted that you can say there's an agave that you have that has sent up a couple of pups at the base. It's in a container. And you want to separate those pups. So pull it out of the container, kind of tease away the roots. If you pull that pup off and it breaks away, as long as the bottom is intact, even if there are no roots, it's going to be fine. You can just let the bottom dry a bit so it's not an open wound, basically, and plant it up in some free-draining mix, and it's going to root and it's going to grow. And because they are so easy, I often mistreat more tender herbaceous plants that actually need their roots. Anybody can do it. Trust me. Very simple.
Well, many of the plants that you love prefer drier climates. Is there a way to mimic or to cheat that in your area if you want to grow a spiky plant and live in an area that's not ideal? Because where you live, most people, Pacific Northwest, rain like 75% of the year. How do you make that work?
That is such a good question. We have very dry summers, so I'm lucky in that regard. But containers are an easy answer. You can move your containers to areas that are under eaves or in a garage if it's a wet time so that they don't get drenched. You can plant with a very free-draining soil mix in a container. Make sure it has great drainage holes. All of that is helpful. But if you do want to plant in the soil, by mounding up the soil rather than planting level with the rest of your garden, but kind of planting on a bit of a berm, and then use pumice and pea gravel and all sorts of very free draining materials to build up that soil and plant on top of it, then the moisture is going to run away from your plant. It also is helpful to kind of tip it so that water is not pooling in the crown of the plant. It runs away. And all plants are not created equal. So you could choose a succulent or a cactus that is hardy to a part of the world that never gets to the temperatures that you get in your part of the world. So make sure you're doing your research and you're planting a plant that is set up for success, that is going to be okay with your temperatures, and just plant it so that you're maximizing the drainage and keeping the water away from the crown of the plant.
Now, you say containers is kind of one of the tricks. Would you recommend any or some of these plants to be grown indoors, or is it best to keep them outside?
Definitely grown indoors as long as you have sufficient light. I am someone who has hundreds of containers, and they are outside in the summertime because I love having them around me there, and the plants love the sunshine, and we, like I mentioned, are dry in the summer. But then I bring them in the winter, and they are under lights in my basement, and some of them go on windowsills. Unfortunately, when I bring them indoors, I have to give them artificial light because here in Portland, Oregon, in the winter, it is just pretty dark and gray. So if you're able to give them the light that they need on a windowsill, then great. They will be just fine.
Okay, great. Well, we've really enjoyed having you on the show. Can you tell our listeners where to find more of your great information and how to find you best?
Certainly. So my blog, I've still published there 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and that's thedangergarden.com. And I'm also on Instagram and cannot stop posting there. So I'm on there virtually daily putting up pictures, and that is also thedangergarden.com, or danger at thedangergarden, sorry. And I'll just throw out my email. If someone wants to email me with a question, I'm happy to answer it. I'm at spikyplants@gmail.com. So, thank you so much for having me here.
You're very welcome. Your book available on your website and all major bookstores?
All major bookstores, Amazon. I do not have it on my website simply because it came out during COVID, and running to the post office was not something that I was really up for. So local bookstores, online bookstores, and that dreaded Amazon.
And the name of the book again is, for our listeners?
Fearless Gardening.
Well, we greatly appreciate the time you've given us, and not only educating Holly and myself, but all of our listeners as well.
Thanks. You guys have a great night.
You too.
Thanks.
And when we come back, it's going to be your garden questions, our garden answers. You're listening to the Garden with Joy and Holly radio show.
Got a question for Joey and Holly? Send it via email anytime to gardentalkradio@gmail.com.
Turf experts always say lawn season begins in the fall. It's the time to help grasses recover from summer stresses and thicken up so it can come back strong in the spring. This fall, you can fertilize, aerate, and dethatch your lawn using just one fantastic liquid product. It's called Lawn Force 5, a five-way lawn care kit in a bottle. Lawn Force 5 gives you a lush, healthy lawn you can be proud of. It improves your soil in a way that gives your lawn great color, using 75% less nitrogen than typical lawn fertilizers. Visit our friends at natureslawn.com to find out more about this amazing Lawn Force 5 product. That's natureslawn.com. Do you want to transform your kitchen waste into a valuable soil amendment? Cousins Compost offers a variety of composting supplies. Cousins Compost's Royal Worm Bedding is designed to produce excellent worm castings. Use coupon code REDWORM21 for 10% off at CousinsCompost.com.
Protect your plants against damage with a 3-in-1 plant guard and special blend fertilizer. Visit IVyOrganics.com. Pomona's Universal Pectin is a high-quality pectin that gels reliably with low amounts of any sweetener. If you're trying to reduce the amount of sugar in your diet, you'll love Pomona's Universal Pectin. Now you can make healthy homemade jams and jellies sweetened to your taste. You can use sugar or honey to sweeten. Pomona's Universal Pectin keeps indefinitely when stored in an airtight container. Easy to use, versatile, and comes with directions and recipes in every box. Find out more and where to buy at PomonaPectin.com. Also available at natural food stores and online.
The Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show is brought to you by the following: Pro Plugger, Dripworks, Walton's Incorporated, Tree Diaper, Janie's Mill, Phylum Bioproducts, Chapin Manufacturing Incorporated, Nature's Lawn and Garden Incorporated, Deer Defeat, Dr. Jim's, Root Maker. Find all sponsors at thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com and thank them for their support. Welcome back to the Gardening with Joy and Holly radio show. Thank you for being with us today. Time for questions and answers. You want to submit a question? You can do that. Two avenues in which that can be accomplished. GardenTalkRadio@gmail.com. That's GardenTalkRadio@gmail.com. Or you can talk to us directly. 1-800-927-SHOW. 1-800-927-7469. Can't get through, leave a message. We'll call you back with a question, with the answer to your question. We had a number of questions come in this week, Holly. Let's see what we can get through to the top of the hour.
Yep. So is it okay to grow fruits and vegetables in the raised bed garden?
Grow together, I assume, is the question would be.
It says tire raised bed garden.
Okay. Tire raised bed garden. Tires, that is a touchy subject. Some studies have shown that the potential of petroleum can leach into the soil, that the chemicals that make up the compounds can leach into the soil and be uptaken by the plant. Short term, some people will say it's not a big deal if you're growing edible plants in a tire or tires. Many people would recommend growing non-edibles such as flowers and paint the tires different colors and do a nice little landscape with them. So we do not personally grow in tires. Growing up on the farm, we did do that in order to warm the soil on a small level. So it's personal preference. People do it. People say it's not right. Other people say it's okay. So we really didn't help with that question very much, I don't think.
I think it's more or less like do what you want to do, what makes you feel okay.
There is a potential that there can be problems long term if the tire leaches enough stuff into the soil.
Right. Okay, so the next question is I want to know when the seeds are ready to harvest from the onion flower.
Okay, onions take 2 years or two growth cycles in order to produce seed. So grew last year, left alone over winter, came back this spring, and now has a very lush flower head on it with several hundreds, if not thousands, of seeds. And typically you wait until the seed pods begin to dry up and open up, and you're going to see dark pellets of material, which is the seeds in which you're saving. Once you begin to see probably 20 to 25% of the plant or the flower head opening up, you can go ahead and snip that head off, put it in a paper sack, and let it finish drying inside in a controlled environment. Paper sack, not plastic. Plastic is going to be ruined, not going to be able to breathe. And the majority of those seeds are going to be to a state of maturity in which you can plant the coming year. So that goes for the same for leeks as well. Next question here, Holly. What do you mean when you say reprocess jars when it comes to canning?
So a lot of people do this when their jars didn't seal. So maybe you did a bunch of canning, you have a couple jars that didn't seal or a handful that didn't seal. What you would do is reprocess it so that you can get that seal. Maybe you're like, oh, I did all this canning, 5 jars didn't seal. I don't feel like just sticking in my fridge. I want them to be shelf stable. So all you're simply going to do is put a new lid on with the ring, put them in your canner at room temperature, water at room temperature, start the boiling process. Once it comes up to boiling, then you will just process it at the same time as before. But that's how you reprocess.
So you got 4 jars that didn't seal. You take the flat piece off, which is the lid, wipe the rims, put new lids on, tighten them finger tight, put them in the canner, jars room temperature, water room temperature, turn the heat on. When it starts boiling, run that clock until the recommended time, and then do the same the procedure as normal as you did prior to the day before.
Yep.
And this is totally safe. If done correctly, just as if you did the first time.
I wouldn't personally, I would not do it for pickles because those pickles are going to be mushy.
Uh-huh.
Peaches,
apples, pears.
Yeah. Even jam might be questionable. I mean, you could try it. It might end up being very jammy or soft.
What, jammy? Don't you want your jam
like
to be jammy?
Extra jammy.
Oh, too much like jam too in jam. Your jam.
Yeah, okay. Too much jam in your jam.
Next question I have had, I have very large Brussels sprout plants and very tiny sprouts on them. The plants are about 3 foot tall. I've never been able to grow successfully large sprouts on a Brussels sprout plant. What am I doing wrong? Well, you're allowing the plant to grow vertically. And you're allowing the plant to continue to grow vertically. About 60 days prior to the end of the season, give or take, as you see a very tiny sprout developing in the junction of the leaf and the stalk, cut about 6 inches off of the top. You see the growth tip, hack that thing off, and what that will accomplish is the vertical aspect of the plant will stop growing. You're going to put the plant in some kind of a stress defense recovery mode, and it's going to start developing the sprouts. By trimming that top 6 inches growth tip off, you will be amazed how large the sprouts become when you allow the plant to stop growing vertical and focus on the sprout. So whenever you begin to see the sprouts develop in the junction of the stalk and the limb, take that growth tip off the top, and you'll do just fine. Well, with that, we are out of time. We thank you for yours. Did you miss any portion of the program today or would like to revisit it? You can do that by going to our parent website, the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com and clicking on the Season 5 tab at the top of the page. Or you can send us an email to GardenTalkRadio@gmail.com, GardenTalkRadio@gmail.com, and we'll send you the link to this program. Tune in next week to the show where we're going to talk about all things pumpkins and garden prep for next spring's garden. Our guest will be author and chef Valerie Rice, and we'll answer your garden questions. So until next week, for
Holly Baird,
I'm Joey Baird, and we will see you in the garden.